Class war, class war.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
My attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no war, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When a system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is your brother Vimer Dees, and welcome to this episode of Class War Battlefield Podcast. Populism is a left concept. I'm amazed. I've mentioned this before, and I remain amazed presently. All of these terms that we ascribe to right-winged people. We ascribe conservatism to right wings. We ascribe libertarianism to right wings. We ascribe populism to right wingers. All are lies. A brilliant rebranding effort by corporate interests. Massively, massively smart people who understood the power in these concepts, which were all tied to the idea of democracy. So they had to go and take those core concepts of democracy and graft them onto the corporate state. I don't ask you to believe me, I ask you to research it. There's always been two types of conservatives. The one that is the most popular, the one that I know of, you know of, everybody knows of, is the elite conservative, which seeks to maintain the status quo. That is the popular conservative, and of course it's going to be popular. It seeks to keep the status quo. The wealthy are going to promote this form of conservatism because it keeps them wealthy and in power. But there's another form of conservatism which was very evident at the end of the 1800s, the 19th century, and that conservatism was brash. It had a long memory. It remembered not only 100 years prior, but it remembered 200 years prior. That conservatism, or that conservative, talked and was buoyed, by the way, by the influx of European immigrants who actually had this tradition in their country. That conservative talked about a time when democracy was direct. It remembered things like the Bacon Rebellion with great enthusiasm, and spoke about the mobilization of the people against unfair, what it saw as unfair, not only taxation, but stationing of troops and what have you by the British. Not everybody obviously wanted to separate from Britain, but they talked about these things and said, why then are we given over our sovereignty to industrialists who keep taking our land, building these massive, massive factories, and paying us so little that we can barely live? These were conservatives, and they were despised. And they were despised. It was from the conservatives that you had the flickerings, the starting up of the flames of populism and socialism and libertarianism. Emerson was a libertarian. And if you read, which I did some years ago, Waldo, I think it's the name of it, you can't place that in the realm of corporate setting, of a corporate setting. It is devoid of hierarchical subjugation. Conservatives were the protectors of freedom. But freedom wasn't freedom as it is defined today, which places everybody in this stranglehold of allegiance to working for corporations. Freedom literally was freedom. Free to have a land, a home, small business, maybe medium business, but not these gigantic juggernauts that are crushing people and killing people without care. This memory of what democracy had been like and what many people expected democracy to become when the United States became its own independent nation. You know, I don't know if there are significant speeches available from individuals like George Washington and stuff. I'd probably need to do some research on that. I didn't think I'd be bringing it up, but watching politics today, I get the sense that there was a lot of promises made back then. These wealthy people saw an opportunity to separate themselves from a class of individuals who weren't enabling them to just amass as much as they wanted to amass. And so they made promises everywhere. They took a look at these brilliant visions and dreams that the farmers and the craftsmen had, not to mention the slaves, because they need to be mentioned. But they took a look at it. And they said, well, we really aren't going to do this, but hey, if we can get them to fight for us, let's do it. The rebellions that were taking place at that time, though, gave a glimpse as to what citizens expected from the revolution, which Gerald Horn says is a counter-revolution. I think he's right. And 100 years later, they had not yet received what they were promised. And that's when the activity to reform society. We look at that word today and we say make incremental, minute changes. No, that's not what reform literally means. You reform something by breaking it down and forming it up again. They were moving to reform the society because the promises that had been made to their grandparents and great-grandparents were not fulfilled. And they had memories of it. And you could tell by the tone of the industrialists that they knew that these promises were made. Many of them made statements concerning the ultimate goals of industrialization. They made statements where they said to them, look, you let us go through this phase and we're going to get to a point where you will have all this leisure time because automation and machines will do the work for you. I don't know if they use the words automation, but definitely machines will be doing the work for you. So you'll have all this leisure time. And this was being promised from the late 1800s to the early 1900s. They stopped doing it around World War I. They stopped making that promise. Just about the time when you had all this activism start cropping up in the white community. They knew that the vision that was still in the hearts of Americans, white Americans, was connected to a vision that had been cast forward generations ago. And they had to play to that until they could upend it. And upend it they did. Upended, they did. They gave some concessions after World War II. Built up a magnificent landscape. And then turned around and said, now you fight to keep it. Because we aren't going to maintain it. And they didn't maintain it. Now, it's important that we realize that from this conservative ethic, which remembered 1776 and what it meant for the people on the ground in the country, not for those taking power, and I mean that literally, taking power, who remembered 1676, time periods of immense change on this continent, the work being done by ordinary people. It's not something that I celebrate because I know what it meant for my people. But it is what is the reality in the hearts and minds of the people who lived then. And from this rose the idea of populism that I actually should add, because this is true. They had some help. It's not as if the conservative ethic they were utilizing gave them ideas for these structures. many of these Europeans had been blown away by how native indigenous people to this land, most of whom were dark-skinned. Yeah, because that needs to be said. Because most people, when they think of Indians, they're white. But no. But no. They were intrigued by the political processes and social processes. They called it political processes, but it was all social cultural to the native indigenous people who were mostly dark-skinned. They were intrigued by that. And they learned about it. They've been learning about it since the 1600s. And what many of them couldn't figure out is how is it that these savages, who we are told by supposedly learned men of God, how is it that these savages have this way of living that is so inclusive, that is beneficial to all, that listens to everybody? How is it that they can do that, and we, who are supposed to be better than them, we can't? And so they wanted to try to reproduce it to show that white society was as better or maybe even better than those native indigenous people. Because if the savages can do it, why can't we? We aren't savage. Forget for a moment what was actually happening, but that's what was being said. And so from this conservatism rose populism, libertarianism, socialism, all inspired by what was seen being done by Native Indigenous people, and because this is equally as important, what was being done in the feudal communities in Europe. Because the feudal communities, which are often looked at from the standpoint of royalty, were just that. They were communities. Even when there was not a lord set over the community, people worked deliberately towards collective aims because it satisfied the needs of the community. And so that way of acting was still in the back of the minds of Americans who were, in fact, European. Who were, in fact, European. So when they took the yearning for what was at home, what they had been able to briefly, for some time, recreate in the United States, granted, they had some help. You know, having slaves do a bunch of the work did aid that lifestyle. But they still lived it. And then seeing the Native Americans, I mean, that's a powerful trinity. They had a yearning to reproduce, an inspiration to produce that way of life. And so that conservative ethic helped spawn all of these things. Because at the heart, conservatism is about maintaining the best in your society. That's what conservatism is there for. This is one of the reasons why when I talk to progressives, I say to them, you don't have an ideology. You don't have a philosophy. You don't have any of that to stand on. And so the question is, where are you going with what you're doing? Because in conservatism, in how it used to be, I mean, this is one of the reasons I believe that conservatism in the early 1900s, well, 1930s really, shifted and started talking about big government, because it wasn't the New Deal, even though it turned into opposition for the New Deal. It was the corporate influence on the government that was trying to be evaded. But in conservatism, you have this broad vision, this incredibly broad vision. Now, the problem with conservatism, and I've made a mention of this before, the problem with conservatism is that in the United States, you have the good with the bad. You have the good with the almost unforgivable Holocaust. And I know Jews like to act as if it's just them. But honest to God, Jews who did suffer horribly at the hands of Nazis can't approach what happened to Africans and to Native Indigenous people on this land. Cannot even approach. Have to duck away in shame when they consider those numbers. Because that Holocaust continues in many, many ways today. So that's the issue with conservatism. If conservatism isn't consciously astute to its higher destiny, then it'll take the good with the bad and commingle them, which is what's happened. You have to sift out, through conservatism, the negative stuff. You have to sift out, through conservatism, the negative stuff. So progressives need to understand this. Because ultimately, progressives do a lot of talking about what is in the past without actually speaking overwhelmingly about what is in the past and how it should be grounded to the present and into the future. They make suggestions about policy, about ways to live, but they don't do much more than that. And it is changing somewhat, but there needs to be a cold, hard vision there. Now, I started off this talking about all of this because there is, like I said, a deep need for a vision. But I want to talk about something that has just absolutely blown my mind. All right, I'm actually trying to load this up right now so I can view it. But there was a study that was done a few years ago, and I give credit to Chris Hedges for alerting me to it, even though he got the figure incorrect. He said 26 when it's actually 29. But there was a study done a couple of years back, I think it was 2014, hopefully this thing loads, which sought to actually figure out how much money was created out of thin air to save the financial institutions in the United States and, you know, Europe and elsewhere. And the figure that they came up with, are you ready for this? Are you, honest to God, sit down, because this figure is going to blow your mind. It blew mine. I had been hearing for years that the estimated amount of money that was created out of thin air to save the financial institution over the course of, you know, 4 or 5 years was around $12 trillion. Okay. I don't know if you understand how much $12 trillion is. But I'm going to give you an idea. Bill Gates is considered the richest man in America, not the world. Sorry for the background noise. Not the world. There are richer people in the world than him. You'll never know most of their names. But not the world. And I think the last time I saw, his net worth was around like $75 billion. You have to times that by 100 to get close to $12 trillion. I mean, that's a lot of money. The United States spends somewhere between $3 and $4 trillion a year at the federal level. $3 or $4 trillion a year at the federal level. That means if it's even $4 trillion, let's just say it's $4 trillion, that is three times the amount of money that the United States spends in a year. That is three United States fiscal years put together in one currency. Well, not one. Okay, they issued currency over the course of 3 or 4 or 5 years. So, but together, you're talking three fiscal years. So, that I thought was amazing. However, that wasn't right. The amount of money actually spent. Alright, so this actually loaded, so I can tell you about this. The Levi Institute. The Levi Institute took a detailed look, and Levi would be L-E-V-Y Institute.org. Took a look at the Fed's bailout. And this was in 2014. If I'm not mistaken. Anyway, the real amount. Would you be shocked if I said it was double? Now, of course, you're going to say no. But honest to God, think about what I just said about $12 trillion. That is three times what the United States spends at a federal level annually. Issued separate from the United States of America and what is issued, you know, each year here for just popular use. Consider this also. I apologize. I said this was from 2014. This is actually from 2011. So this is even more egregious because I was giving it 4 or 5 years when in fact the bailout started in 2008, so by 2011, they knew that this thing was at 20, well, we'll get to that in a moment. Think about this fact before I give you the actual number, because it boggles my mind. The United States has had a GDP of 18.57 trillion US dollars in 2016. The United States of America had a GDP, that's gross domestic production, that is what we create as a economy, totally, as an economy. This doesn't count the financial sector, by the way. But we had a GDP of 18.57 trillion dollars US 2016. So when I say to you, does doubling $12 trillion shock you? To say no is not to understand this type of a comparison. This type of a comparison. The United States has a GDP of $18.57 trillion. If you double what I had originally heard, which was $12 trillion. If you double that, that's $24 trillion. That is larger than the United States GDP of 1 year. but hold on to your horses, because the Levi Institute didn't find that the bailout cost $24 trillion. What they found was that the totality of all of the currency issuances cost $29 trillion. $29 trillion. Let me break some of this down for you. I'm not going to go into where the money went to or what have you. I want you to understand the size of this thing. I said before, if we look at the United States as spending $4 trillion a year, we were talking about three fiscal years when we were looking at $12 trillion. We are now talking about seven fiscal years. Seven fiscal years plus one quarter. When you are looking at $29 trillion plus one quarter. Moreover, what is just staggering about this is if we laid that 7 years out from when the Bush cuts, tax cuts, went into effect, which was 2001, do you understand, ladies and gentlemen, that we would literally come into the year of the financial crisis? Clinton had increased taxes, and when Bush stole the office in 2001, he rolled those increases back, immediately pumping up the deficit. If we were to take what was spent to bail out those institutions, it would literally bring us up to the crises, right into the year. If we were just to look at 2001, and not once when it actually took effect, which I believe was 2002, which if you laid it out then we are in the middle of the crises, or not in the middle of it, but we are actually after they had started issuing the money. So you're talking about 7 years, seven fiscal years of wealth it took to bail out the institutions that almost crashed the economy. Now, what did they do with that money? Did they create new jobs? No. Did they pay off or make sure current jobs had a stable or current companies who were in the United States had open line of credit? No, many companies actually had a difficult time getting credit. What they did with it was they fixed up their offices, gave themselves really good bonuses, put it into tax havens, and said, screw the United States citizenry. Why include this on a episode that I started talking about conservatism and its connection to democracy and populism and libertarianism? Why do that? I do it for one simple reason. The vision. One of my biggest critiques about the so-called progressives is they don't have vision. And they don't seem to care that they don't have a vision. Whereas conservatives, neoconservatives, present-day conservatives, have a vision that is very destructive. And yet progressives don't have anything that speaks to what they say they supposedly believe. If you believe something, then build it. Have something that you can build forward towards. If you don't have that, then you can't expect people to support you. You're peddling them, you're peddling false, I don't even want to use the word hope. But you're promoting yourself as a savior when you're not. Chris Hedges made this mention, and he made it after I was thinking it. What could you do with, if the Fed could create out of thin air $29 trillion for banks? That means they just let us all in on a wonderful little secret. None of the crap that they have us following actually is real to them. Because if it was, they would have never created that money. That money, $29 trillion, literally makes, if what they said goes, if those rules were real, the United States money would be worthless right now, because $29 trillion is exactly what I just said it is. It's $29 trillion. We could have literally, we could have literally paid for every person, every family in the United States to have decent housing with $29 trillion. Could have wiped out school debt just by using $1.5 trillion of it, you know, a couple trillion, just done. Had a universal healthcare system that actually worked. Do you know, $29 trillion, you could literally rebuild all of the infrastructure. You can get factories going again. $29 trillion. And all you have to do is just repeatedly pump that into the economy for about 5 years, and it would hum like it was nothing. And it would be more efficient. Here's another interesting stat that I think you'd like. In 2014, according to the CIA, the globe had a global world production value of around $78 trillion. It was a little bit over $78 trillion. $78 trillion, and it took $29 trillion to keep these institutions floating. So it took more than 1 year of GDP of the United States, and it took over a third of global production to save, and this is just the United States, to save these institutions. And none of us outside of those institutions received any benefit from it. $29 trillion. It kind of makes you now understand why Occupy Wall Street was that popular. $29 trillion. It boggles the mind what could be done with that kind of money to alleviate the stresses and problems of the American people. $29 trillion. $29 trillion. It's fascinating to me. And if we had a true conservative movement to reconnect us to the craftsman tradition, to the idea of commonwealth and community, the real sense of those words, the true meaning, and this is a newer concept, of humanitarian instinct, where we don't hide from the problems that were created by the injustices of the past. We now seek to overturn those problems, solve the issues created, heal the wounds created, and reset the order so that the divine light can shine here once again. If we had that type of a movement that promoted democracy, then the world would again follow our lead. But since we don't, we have what we have here now. And that is a crisis so large and so penetrating that at the end, I fear that at the end of the next decade, the United States will be in a spiraling mess. We are trying to dig our way somewhat out of it, but it may be too late. I want to thank you all for listening. If you do have any questions, any comments, any concerns, you always know you can reach out to me. I look forward to hearing from you. I always do. And sometimes I don't have the opportunity to connect back with you. Don't feel, you know, that I'm ignoring you. I will try to get back to anybody who does reach out to me within a couple of weeks. All right. That concludes today's show, ladies and gentlemen. New podcast coming soon. I know I was talking about this last year at the same time. But things have definitely changed. And I'm in a different place than I was then. Much love to all of you. I'll see you next time. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio talk shows and the TV, you hear one thing again and again. How the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone, and they're alone.